Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Imagine this, a family of six living isolated for more than 40 years in a tiny cabin on the vast Siberian taiga. If this were the 19th century, it may not be so far-fetched. If it were a 21st century reality show, there would be more drama and more bikinis. It was 1978 when four geologists prospecting for iron discovered the Lykovs. Karp Lykov and his wife Akulina fled the Soviet purges of the 1930s and headed for the forest. There they had two more children and remained unaware that World War II, the moon landing, the Cold War, or the advent of television had even happened. Author Mike Dash wrote in the Smithsonian Magazine about the life the Lykov family chose to live before and after their so-called rediscovery. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First, the geography lesson. The Siberian taiga, if I'm pronouncing that properly, covers about 5 million square miles. Tell us about that landscape and where the Lykov family was living.
Well, the landscape is, it's a forest. It's not a thick forest. It's large, straggly strands of sort of tall birch trees and larch trees interspersed with extensive areas of bog and mountainside. So it's a wilderness, but it's not an impenetrable wilderness. It's more just that it's so vast that nobody had actually sort of progressed on foot through very large quantities of it. So, in fact, it's an area, you know, where there are tens of thousands of miles that have never essentially seen a human foot on it. And the Lykovs found an area like that, which is around about 100, 150 miles north of the border with Mongolia. So it's in the southern part of what was the old Soviet Union, in an area which, you know, the climate is very, very variable. It's harsh winters, very short springs in autumn, and short, quite hot summers. But for, you know, 8-9 months of the year, you've got freezing cold weather and snow on the ground. It's not an area where most of us would find it at all easy to survive, even for a few days.
Why did the Lykov family leave Soviet Russia and retreat to such an isolated place?
Well, the Lykovs were old believers. That's essentially a fundamentalist Eastern Orthodox sect who practice a form of religion that goes back to the 9th or 10th centuries. And at the time of Peter the Great, there were reforms forced on the Orthodox Church, which the old believers disagreed with. And a large number of them then, this is in the early 1700s, left European Russia and went to Siberia. Now, the Lykovs, their family were part of that group, but then in the 1930s, of course, at the height of Stalin's purges, in an atheist Russia, there was a lot of persecution of Christians generally, and at one point in 1936, Karp Lykov and his brother were planting potatoes in a field in this little Siberian village where their family lived. When a communist patrol came into the village, there was an altercation, and Lykov's brother was shot dead as he stood next to him. So he responded to that by scooping up his family, which at that time consisted of his wife and two very young children, a 9-year-old boy and a 2-year-old girl, and heading off into the forest. And over the next 3 or 4 years, they gradually went further and further and deeper into the taiga and ended up in this area, which essentially was completely uninhabited and was completely off the grid as far as the USSR were concerned. And they just vanished. Nobody knew where they were. Nobody much cared where they were, I don't think. And they weren't seen again for 42 years.
How did they live out there in this dense, isolated taiga, as you said, variable climate, kind of on the edge of famine? What did they eat?
Well, I mean, they were unbelievably tough, is the simple answer. And yes, I mean, although in a sense it sounds like an almost romantic situation to be self-sufficient and not have to worry about taxes and what anyone else thinks of you, I mean, the reality is that they did spend a very large amount of that 4 decades on the brink of starvation. I mean, they didn't literally pick up their children and run into the forest at the time of the shooting. They planned it a little bit and they went off with quite a large amount of stuff. But I mean, it was only the stuff that they could carry with them. So it's certainly not a gigantic quantity of provisions. But what they did take was, you know, a basis of seeds, for example. So their staple diet for most of this time was rye, potatoes, forest fruits and mushrooms that they could gather. Very rarely were they able to actually eat meat, because it wasn't until their son, they had another son while they were out of the taiga, and they had took one with them. Only when those sons grew to adulthood were they able to do any effective sort of hunting. And lacking modern weaponry, for example, or even the ability to make bows and arrows, the best way of hunting was what's called persistence hunting, which essentially means that you chase an animal until it drops dead of exhaustion, at which point you then have to carry it back to your homestead over these mountains a distance of 5, 10, 20, 40 miles. So it's an enormously difficult, challenging life that they led.
Mike Dash is author of Tulipomania, Thug and the First Family. He's with us today to talk about an article he wrote about a Russian family who lived burrowed into a bluff in the Siberian forest for almost half of the 20th century. Well, of course, they were found, retreated to the forest in 1936, discovered in 1978. And I say discovered in, quotation marks. Tell us about that first contact.
Well, what happened was that the Soviet Union was attempting to exploit the mineral wealth of Siberia, which is a very rich area from that point of view, and had sent a party of geologists into this area to prospect for iron ore. And they were sent out with some helicopter pilots who were assigned to find them a safe place to land and set up a camp. And in the course of flying down this unknown river valley, the pilots noticed a clearing on the side of a mountainside which shouldn't have been there, essentially. And as they got a bit closer, they realized that it had furrows and had been plowed, and so there must be some sort of habitation. They didn't land there then, but they did warn the geologists that there must be some sort of human being out there. And this can be quite a dangerous thing, of course, when you're out in the taiga. You don't know who's out there, whether they're armed or dangerous. So the geologists decided on one fine day that they'd sort of take the initiative and go and have a look at this place. And they walked up the side of the mountain. It was about 6,000 feet above sea level, and encountered this sort of low hut built, as you say, into the side of a hill. And the door opened, the door creaked open, and this very elderly man wearing an enormously patched sort of sack suit, essentially, of homemade clothing came out, and looking very nervously, saying, well, if you've come this far, you'd better come in. And when they went inside, it was only then really that they realized quite what they were faced with, because, this is a hovel of indescribable filth with virtually no natural light. The only window was the size of a backpack pocket to keep what little heat there was in. And two absolutely terrified young women praying, saying, this visitation is for our sins, essentially. These girls had never seen another human being outside their own family. So it was a completely terrifying incident for them, and the geologists had to leave the house very rapidly because the situation was deteriorating. But over a period of time, they gradually became more friendly, and of course, this is when the interesting sort of interactions start to occur.
What did these kids who were raised in the wilderness think of these strangers and their wristwatches and their technologies? And did they want to leave the forest?
Well, they didn't. I mean, they had been brought up, obviously, as religiously quite fervent, and the one survivor of the family, in fact, is still out there even now. She's in her 70s. So no, they didn't want to leave. It was what they were used to, and what they had been told was best for their immortal souls, essentially. What did happen was a very interesting process of sort of gradual acclimatization, almost, to the 20th century. And when the geologists first encountered the family, they offered them various gifts, and the constant refrain was, we are not allowed that. I mean, their religion forbade them almost everything. The only thing they would take on this first encounter was salt. They'd had no salt apart from what they could get out of the natural foods they were eating for 40 years, which the father of the family said was the greatest torture of all, in fact. But gradually these sort of prohibitions were worn down by the necessity of living, and they started to take one or two more things, and eventually when they got to know each other a little bit better, the family agreed to go down the river to meet the geologist at their camp. And then they did encounter a lot of very modern technology, including things like television, which they found completely strange and bizarre, but very compelling. One of the most interesting things about this, I think, was that, how well they'd adapted in some respects. I mean, when they were told, for example, that man had walked on the moon, they refused to believe it. They hadn't seen it with their own eyes. But what they had seen since the 1950s were satellites moving across the sky. They didn't know what they were, of course, but they'd seen these stars that move quicker than other stars. And the father had actually proposed a theory to explain this, saying, that men must have found a way of sending fire up into the sky, which, when you think about it, is not that far off what was actually happening. So they certainly weren't stupid people, but they were very much unaware of a lot of what had been going on. It did take them some time to adapt and to realise that they had access to things that had taken them days and days and days to sort sort of painstakingly hand carve could be produced in the little sawmill in the geologist's camp in a half an hour was quite a shock to their system, I think.
Mm. And within a couple of years of that first contact, several members of the family were dead, you know, after decades of living in isolation. Did the contact have anything to do with those deaths in your mind?
I think this is a very interesting question. I mean, the geologists themselves were insistent this wasn't the case. What happened was that two of the family died of kidney failure and one of pneumonia. Now, the man who died of pneumonia refused a medical evacuation that probably would have saved him, again, on the grounds of, you know, his religion. His essential view was, you know, a man lives for howsoever God grants, and if God wants you to die at that point, then it's your duty, essentially, to die, which is a tragic outcome because he was essentially the most inquisitive and the favourite of the geologists. But the others, the two who died of kidney failure, it's interesting to speculate on that because I think that it's certainly possible that variations in their diet, and particularly the introduction of a lot more salt, for example, might explain that. So I think that the chances are that, yes, some of these deaths were directly linked to the rediscovery, to their contacting civilization once again.
Mike, we have just a moment left, but I'm just curious about you. You know, you've written all sorts of interesting little bits about history and written about another family, a mafia family. Just wondering what the fascination is for you with the Lykoffs.
Well, I think that all of the things I write tend to have a common theme, which is the sort of extremes of human experience. I just tend to think that when we study the extremes, we learn quite a lot about what it's like to be human. In the Lykoffs case, you know, surviving by yourself and being self-reliant. In the case of, I wrote about the Dutch tulip mania, you know, what great financial temptation does for us. I wrote another book about a ship that got wrecked off the coast of Australia in the 1620s and degenerated into a mutiny. And again, it's those sort of extreme situations that reveal us at our best and our worst. And I think that that's the fascination of history to me.
Mike Dash, author of Tulipomania, Thug, and the First Family. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, he spoke with us today about an article he wrote about a Russian family who lived pretty much burrowed into a bluff in the Siberian forest for almost half of the 20th century. The article we found in Smithsonian Magazine. We have a link to it online at wordofmouthradio.org. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth in just a moment. The dawning of another era, the video game era. Thank you.